I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Or let me know.
Yeah, yeah.
I see.
You asking her questions?
I got
it. Good, how you doing?
No, let me tell you, they knew about Niagara.
When we think about Niagara Falls, many of us immediately conjure up images of one of the great wonders of the world. But the area is also recognized as an endpoint to the Underground Railroad. This is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and myself and host Jay Moran are in Niagara Falls on a walking tour of the Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center. We are joined by the Heritage Center's Director of Community Engagement, Saladin Allah, to get a history lesson on how the past influences the present.
So, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Center. Right now, we've got a couple groups coming through, a couple groups of kids coming through. Tell us about the center. Tell us about the history of the center.
Yeah, so first, I think it's important to state that this is the first Black institution in the city of Niagara Falls in over 30 years. And that's vitally important because what that indicates is a community of our people here's voices and heritage and history hasn't been told or shared in the public domain. And we pride ourselves on that. That's the foundation of our mission, centering Black voices and making sure that our community members' voices and their heritage and history is actually shared. We're right inside of 1863 Customs House, and this was on one of the seven sites to save in New York State. So a bunch of us as community advocates, public officials had to come together to literally save this building. Once we saved that building, we had to restore it, put it on a historic registry, and it took about a decade of advocacy and research in order to discover the stories of the Underground Railroad. And then we hired a design firm, and eventually what came to be established was our Underground Railroad Heritage Center.
So you had the idea over a decade ago for a heritage center, but you needed to find a building, or did you have this building kind of like, we like this place?
Well, the process was actually organic, and I think that the most beautiful thing about the process is we live in a city where there's a lot of apathy, right? And a lot of times community members may not think that they have the capacity or agency to be able to be involved in projects like this. So to be able to take something from inception to conception was huge in terms of people seeing what was possible, especially under circumstances where many people did not believe or have confidence or faith in our ability to actually create this institution. And for it to be a thriving institution here today is something that is very, very important.
You know, it's interesting to hear that you had, once you got rolling, then you had to do the research.
Yes.
So you were still just finding out stories that of what really happened here back in the 19th century.
Yeah, even to this day.
Yeah.
Even to this day, you know? And that is also something that we strive to encourage people to take away with them when they come into our space, that history is lived experience. And we want people to be inspired when they come into our space and not only learning about the everyday people who are doing the extraordinary things as a part of this network to freedom here in the city of Niagara Falls, but to also be inspired to investigate stories in their own family of freedom seekers. They may have not been a part of the Underground Railroad, but if they live here in America, if they're indigenous here, they have a story of freedom. If they immigrated here, they have a story of freedom. So we want to inspire people to uncover those stories and to realize the power of agency in those stories so they could get a better perspective of themselves and what they have the capability of doing today in terms of this modern network to freedom that's necessary.
It's interesting also how you mentioned Niagara Falls as being a community of apathy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm an outsider. I mean, I'm from Buffalo, so I'm only can say that I kind of have always seen that about the Falls to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Well, what about, you know, you know, when we think of the Falls from the outside, maybe we're thinking about, you know, the city government and whatever the case may be. I'll follow you along here, Saladin.
Yep.
But, you know, what about, the, you know, for a black person in Niagara Falls? I mean, is that as much part of that apathy as you know, as, like I said, like from an outsider's view, was is that part of trying to get that community, that spirit moving forward for this project?
Yeah, and not only in terms of centering the voices of black people or people of African descent within a city, but also being demonstrative or to demonstrate the possibility of doing that for all community members, because this is our history here in the city of Niagara Falls, which is connected to a national history. We offer free membership to every citizen in our city. So every person that lives here that has a residence in Niagara Falls and all of the members of their household can literally come to our Heritage Center free at all times. It's a neighborhood membership.
Okay.
So that sense of ownership is important to show and to demonstrate to people that this is actually yours. It's not just one segment of our population or our citizenry's, you know, institution, but this is something that we all own.
Was there, but to get that momentum going, can you maybe remember some of the kind of maybe the stumbling blocks or the times where it was like things were moving along a little slowly and maybe this was not going to happen?
Well, sometimes when you have a vision, everybody doesn't share in that vision. You may see something clearly, but also you have to hold grace for people that what you may clearly see, that may be the first time that they've ever even thought about your idea. So it's hard to have a sense of confidence in something that they've never even thought about. So that is a unique challenge that comes along with any vision when you're striving to take something from inception to conception. And then also, along with that disbelief or lack of participation, is finances. Some people may not see the value of cultural heritage tourism, because that is exactly what this institution is when it comes to our local economy. It's cultural heritage tourism. People go and they travel different places to learn about history and lived experiences that only took place in that area. And oftentimes you may have people in certain positions that don't understand the value of cultural heritage tourism. Niagara Falls is right in our backyard. So it's easy to understand the value of tourism when it comes to that. But what about the cultural assets? What about the architecture? What about the stories connected to the architecture and the cultural assets? Sometimes you have to be able to articulate that to people who have never thought about that before in their life. And it may take time for them to actually be willing to invest in that. But you also have to do work to demonstrate to them the value of that at the same time.
Were there some tough conversations that you had trying to get your vision across to people?
There's always tough conversations. I mean, our space is created to have tough conversations, because some people are not even able to have a comfortable conversation about slavery, about social justice, about diversity, equity, inclusion in their own household. So we create that type of not just safe space, but a courageous space for people to have those type of conversations and see the relationship of the past and how it gives you insight into the present and how we can move forward into the future. So when people come into our space, we have conversations about the current political landscape. We have conversations about books being banned in certain, you know, school districts in cities around the country. You know, we have those type of conversations, and facilitating those conversations willfully, we can help encourage people to come to a conclusion of agency, what they can actually do about that. Because again, we're oftentimes fighting apathy and a person's inability to think that they have the agency to do something. So,
Well, before we went on the air, you gave us a little background, and I thought this is a really interesting thing about when you were getting your architect to help put this together and design this place, you had to separate from the original designer. Mm-hmm. Let's get into that story a little bit, because it tells us a lot about just about how the narrative of America is spoken, I think, to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. You had to separate ways mm-hmm. with this designer. Give us that background.
Yeah, so one of the things that I was mentioning is that a lot of times when you're dealing with stories that are specific to a community of people that may have never been centered historically, it may be very challenging for others to feel comfortable enough to allow those stories to actually be centered.
Right.
And there's a lot of conversation that goes on. I mean, women understand this all of the time. You know, I tell people, when you look at women, women are typically considered minorities, right? But when you look at it from a numerical perspective, women, when you look at ratios, there are more women in the population than men. So when they say minority, that is not a definition in terms of numerical value. They're being called minorities based upon the definition of being lesser important and significant, which means when it comes to dynamics of power, women's voices and their presence is oftentimes not centered in spaces. And it may be very difficult for men or males who have always been accustomed to being the center of a conversation or the decision maker or the leader to step aside and to respect the fact that a woman may be best qualified to be able to be centered in that situation, right? I mean, even when we talk about history, that's exactly what it is. It's his story. It's not her story. It's not the story. It's definitely not our story. So that was a challenge that we encountered in terms of a design firm, because it was difficult for them to appreciate and value our perspective as experts in this history. And at the same time that we know exactly what we're talking about in terms of the vision and what we have, what we would like to see.
So there was some, again, going back to this relationship with this ex designer, mm-hmm. there was a sense that, or an air that you, the people that were putting together the Cultural Heritage Center, didn't know what they were talking about? I mean, am I kind of understanding that?
That's part of it, and that's coming from a perspective of a dynamic of power where you have a status quo where the majority of the experts, the majority of the people who control the institutions, the economy, and the resources are people who are of the global minority, aka people who will be classified as white. And because a story is oftentimes told from that perspective, anybody else's story, that's of lesser importance and significance. You're a minority. And it's challenging sometimes to engage people to even have this conversation, because this may be the first time that someone even thought about it, where you come into a room and someone may not even be conscious enough to realize that they're dominating the conversation and don't even have enough awareness to realize you need to step back a little bit and to respect other people's voices in this room. You know, subtle things like that, when it just comes to basic social norms, are the result of a hierarchy or a social dynamic that was created in a society since the forefounders actually established this country.
I think I already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Mm-hmm. When you consider other, you know, cultural heritage sites mm-hmm. around the United States, mm-hmm. you know, I love going into these historical things. Mm-hmm. Are a lot of those, though, that, Jim, you don't necessarily have to name any, but where it's exactly that, where the whole story may be being missed because it's going back to this kind of traditional, you know, white centric, mm-hmm. you know, type of a narrative.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And that's the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? So a lot of times when people talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, they question the qualifications of making things diverse or equitable and inclusive. They're questioning the people who are usually more than qualified to be in that position. The focus really should be on the fact that if this organization or company has only had white men at the helm of this for 75 years, why do you believe and think that these have been the only people qualified to serve in that capacity? That's what we need to question. Not the fact that you have people who are more than qualified to serve in that capacity, but why do you think that this status quo and the way that you functioned with a sense of normalcy for all of these generations is okay? Because you genuinely believe that these are the only people who have been qualified to serve in that capacity. That's what needs to be examined and questioned, not the people who actually have those type of qualifications. So I say that to say, when you look across this country and the various different heritage centers or institutions or all of the various different organizations that are being established, you always have those dynamics that are going to be at play, depending upon where the location is and what the demographic looks like.
Should we move locales?
Sure, we can move along. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll continue our conversation here on What's Next after this short break.
Public Media is more than Morning Edition and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Buffalo Toronto Public Media creates digital series to ignite curiosity in young learners, free lesson plans, videos and training for teachers and parents, and events to empower the minds of our community's next generation. This is Public Media.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits, featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
Explore the intersection of music and mental health with Mindful Music, hosted by mental health advocate and educator Carl Schellhorn. Listen to guests share how they use music to express their inner nature and manage their emotional well-being. Listen to Mindful Music on Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. on WBFO.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. If you have a story or concern that we should be addressing, email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
You're listening to What's Next, emanating from the Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center with their Director of Community Engagement, Saladin Allah.
So what do we have here? So this is a cataract house, and this is our gallery, and we teach people about the activity of the heroic wait staff and members of our community here in Niagara Falls who successfully operated one of the most sophisticated underground railroad networks, not only here in Western New York, but across the country.
So what made it so sophisticated? Let's get into that, the specifics of
these. One thing about it is it sat right in proximity to the Falls. So if you're thinking about a person who's traveling from the South, coming through the Midwest, that long journey to freedom, once they arrived here in Niagara Falls, this is literally the last stop. And they had one river for them to cross to get into freedom. And if they arrived here after 1827, New York abolished slavery gradually after 1827.
But they were still allowing people to come and arrest or take
absolutely
back.
Absolutely. Right. So they gradually abolish slavery,
Right.
And that's also a point. Like, some people may believe that laws or legislation changes people's attitudes, but, you know, anytime a law is passed, it's gradually introduced into the legal landscape, right? And it was the same way here in New York. But the Cataract House was built in 1825. Two short years later, you have slavery being abolished in New York State, and you have a staff of all people of African descent who are free. So imagine coming from a place like Virginia, and you are here as a body servant or to take care of a small child with your enslavers, and you're here staying at the Cataract House amongst a staff of people who look just like you, and the majority of them actually live on the Canadian side. So we've never seen a place like that before that existed in terms of an underground railroad network other than here. This is the only place that this actually existed. So the Cadillac House was a luxurious hotel. It was world renowned. You had European dignitaries who would come all the way from Europe just to stay here. Southern enslavers would come and bring people that they enslaved as body servants. You would also have people like Austin Stewart, who was a famous author of 22 Years a Slave, 40 Years a Freeman, who stayed here. So this was also an integrated space, right? So it was very different from other lodging accommodations in the hospitality industry here in Niagara Falls at that time. And this was the key location that helped facilitate freedom for people to get across to the Canadian side.
Now, how did the employees of the Cataract House get that word out that this is a safe spot, this is a safe place for African Americans to go to?
Well, this hotel was a part of a hospitality industry, and that hospitality industry was a part of a community. So it's kind of like when we talk about Buffalo, and we say that Buffalo has the moniker of being the city of good neighbors. That is indicative of a community, right? So you had the same kind of community here. It doesn't mean that people weren't here to have pro-slavery sentiments, but they were vastly outnumbered by people who were either bystanders or active abolitionists who would be willing to help someone. So this would have been like a sanctuary city of the past, the same way that we see like sanctuary cities of the present day.
The story of itself, of the Cataract House of itself, is just a great story, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what do we know about the stories and the interactions that were going on between, like you said, somebody traveling from Virginia who was in fear for their freedom all the way here, mm-hmm. coming here? What do we know about those stories? Do you have information? Is that stuff that you're still learning about?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned before, these stories are still being uncovered. So to my left, we have a digital copy of our Cataract House registry. And we have many names in this registry that we still have not fully investigated.
Really?
There may even be present day citizens in this city who are directly connected to people who are in this registry, right? And stories that are connected to the people's names who are in this registry. One of the challenges with being able to put these stories together is that finding out about some of the travelings or comings and goings of enslaved people, because this was an underground or a secret network, people oftentimes wouldn't talk about certain things. But oftentimes people will write letters back and forth to each other. You know, if you're trying to investigate community activities or things that were going on in terms of events, if you're trying to check primary records like newspapers, it may look like certain communities are completely invisible. So you're not going to see a person of African descent being a part of a certain organization, usually in newspapers going back in the early 1800s, who started the organization or who got married or who had a child or, you know, there was a wedding over here or this organization had this event. You may not see those kind of activities when it came to people of African descent because we were considered not human and we also were not recognized as citizens. So a lot of our records that we kept were either church records, organization minutes, photo albums. If you look at the back of pictures and it has names and dates or maybe other information on the back of those pictures, we've had to be able to connect dots in a different way in comparison to the access and the opportunities that other people have had. So tracing those stories and those journeys is oftentimes very difficult. When you look at nowadays, you have Ancestry.com, which is a great resource because a lot of times people upload census records. And even when you're looking at census records, that's challenging because when people traveled, sometimes they would change their names. And if you were striving to escape slavery and your name was John in Georgia, by the time you got to New York, your name might be James and you're from Alabama. So people would oftentimes make choices like that in order to elude their captors. And that oftentimes also makes it difficult to be able to trace and connect some of those stories.
This law was actually written in the 1700s. Speaking of stories,
mm-hmm.
you've got a personal story.
Yes.
From the Underground Railroad.
Absolutely. So My third great grandfather is a man by the name of Josiah Henson. And Josiah Henson was the protagonist or the lead character that the author Harriet Beecher Stowe used in her famous 19th century novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. She published that book in the mid 1850s, shortly after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act. And when she published this book, my third great grandfather's biography was actually circulating amongst abolitionist reading circles. So his book is called Josiah Henson, Formerly a Slave, Now an Inhabitant of Canada, narrated by himself. And his book was published in 1849. So because his book was published during that time period, people got exposure to who he actually was.
Okay.
He actually made his journey from Owensboro, Kentucky, and it took him and his family 41 days to travel from Owensboro, Kentucky, and he had four small children with him. Two were so small, he had to carry them in a knapsack on his back. Took that journey from Owensboro, Kentucky, made it through Ohio, stayed with an indigenous tribe there that welcomed them into their village, known as the Anishinaabe, gave them food, lodging. Two scouts in the morning time pointed them in the direction of Sandusky, Ohio. Once they got to Sandusky, Ohio, they were able to board a ship called the Schooner Commerce that was captained by a man named John Burnham, and he took them from Sandusky, Ohio, right to Buffalo, New York. And they crossed on October 28, 1830, in a place that is known as Freedom Park. Today it's known as Broderick Park, or the foot of ferry, right across over into Fort Erie. And then from there, I lived in a community right across on the Fort Erie side, known as Little Africa, for several years. And then the family moved further north to a place that was called Dawn. Today it's known as Dresden, Ontario, Canada. He was able to found an entire community there known as the Dawn Settlement, built the British American Institute, and then he would also come back and forth into the United States in the role of an abolitionist. So his story became well known once he published his biography, and that is what Harriet Beecher Stowe got actually exposed to. Now, when she published her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, it was the best-selling novel of the 19th century, and it was the first time that slavery was actually put on public display. So she got a lot of negative backlash because people were saying that she was making up stories because it was a novel. People started to create stage plays and discredit her, write letters and newspapers and say that she was lying. So shortly after that, she published a second book called The Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin. In this book, she cites all of her references where she did her research, and she mentions my third great grandfather by name in three different passages, and says that he was the inspiration behind her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, there's another part of this story. When Abraham Lincoln drafted the Emancipation Proclamation, he checked a copy of The Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin out of the Library of Congress in 1862. So between June and July, he's actually utilizing this book as the basis for his drafting of the Emancipation Proclamation. And then he writes the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. Shortly after that, he meets Harriet Beecher Stowe, and the first words out of his mouth is, "You're the little lady that started this war in this country, huh?" So she's looked at as the wick that sparked or ignited the Civil War, but behind all of that is my third great grandfather.
Wow.
So you're going through this.
We'll continue our conversation here on What's Next after this short break.
Hey, educators, you've been asking for it, and it's here. Reading Rainbow Stories is ready to help your students stay on track. Each story is paired with activities to help students strengthen cross-curricular skills such as math and business in Lemonade for Sale.
Let's keep track of our sales.
Science and health in Germs Make Me Sick.
Usually, you feel better after a day or two.
Thanks.
But if you don't, you should see a doctor.
And history in Following the Drinking Gourd.
One of the worst things about slavery is that families were separated. Fathers, mothers, and children were oftentimes sold to different people.
Check out the new Reading Rainbow Stories collection on PBS Learning Media today to help your students stay on track.
Join WBFO every Saturday at 6 p.m. for an insightful and enlightening series of audio documentaries from our region that tackle topics such as the environment, health, the world of entertainment, and more. Listen to the WBFO DocuHour every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on WBFO, your NPR station.
explore the Underground Railroad's final stop, learn about how the Latine workforce organized to overcome discrimination, and follow the timeline of immigration in Western New York.
So remember, history surrounds you and includes you.
Watch Compact History on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
Hey people, it's Corey here for some Compact Civics. Raise your hand if you've ever heard in New York State that it's illegal to walk around with an ice cream cone in your back pocket. Yeah, me too. Urban legend or not, what if this law was real in your hometown and you wanted it to be repealed? Look, I don't care what kind of freaky stuff you're into, and it's your right to have messy pants. So how would you go about changing a law as a voter? Well, one way is through a referendum. A referendum is a direct vote on a ballot covering a specific issue, and there are two types. Mandatory referendums are legally required for certain actions like ratifying your constitution, authorizing some big public spending plan, or raising your taxes. Optional referendums are proposed by the government or the people in response to a demand. These can be legislative referrals, asking the public what they think before passing a law, or there's a recall to remove an elected official before their term ends. Then there are citizen-led initiatives to propose new laws or oppose existing ones. So put that ice cream cone back in your pocket. No judgment here. Referendums are direct democracy, y'all. They serve as a check on government power and give the public a voice.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
You're listening to What's Next, emanating from the Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center with their Director of Community Engagement, Saladin Awa.
What?
They know. They about to get the tour for me after this.
You just teach them about that term?
What?
So it's your third great-grandfather's?
Yes. So my grandmother, Inez Dorsey, was born through his family in St. Catharines.
Okay.
So St. Catharines was a community of people of African descent that was known as Colored Village. And this is the community that Harriet Tubman temporarily settled in. And she was also a member of the British Methodist Episcopal Church that still stands to this day. My cousin, Rochelle Bush, is the executive director of the Harriet Tubman Chapel that's in St. Catharines. And my grandmother, she went to that church as well. And then she moved over here into the United States in 1925. So a lot of my family left the United States and was gone for 100 years in Canada before my grandmother moved over here into the United States.
Man,
like I mentioned, when I was growing up, I knew this, but it really didn't mean much to me, you know. But I think as I've gotten older, I begin to have more of a deeper appreciation and more of a sense of exploration in terms of who I am and, you know, my journey in life.
I want to follow up on that just for a second. When you look at that for yourself, do you think it's because we get older, we get wiser, or do you think maybe also it's a reflection of things that people have grown to understand over the years and has made you maybe a little more aware? It's kind of a tough self-reflection I'm asking about, but I'm curious what you think.
Well, I could definitely tell you that just because you're older, you do not become wiser.
I got a whole family.
You know? But a lot of it has to do with your family dynamics, you know, and the type of trajectory that you're set up on in your early developmental years of growth and development. I grew up in a household where my parents were social and culturally conscious, So my father collected African artifacts. He always taught me and my siblings about classical African civilizations and how were the fathers and mothers of civilization. They were, both of my parents were part of the Black Panthers, so they were always involved in the community. They understood the importance of youth advocacy. My father always created employment opportunities for me and my siblings and our peers. So they were always rooted in community, right? So growing up, I literally saw the value of a village raising children because my parents literally did that, right? And it's something that I didn't have to guess. I grew up and I became an educator working within the community. I'm the director of community engagement here. It's just a natural growth from the way in which I was raised, and I didn't depart from that.
Right.
You know, so a part of that is also the type of values that you're raised with. My parents never taught me to think certain ideas. They always taught me how to think and to critically examine life and critically examine my own life. And with that is something that I just carry with me. And it's nothing special, I think, in comparison to other people. I think that some people may have not had that opportunity to have that type of foundation or family dynamics. And sometimes, even when people don't have that foundation or family dynamics, they still find their way. And I think that speaks a lot to just not just the sense of humanity, but the infinite potential that exists beyond that sense of humanity.
We'll step outside the Heritage Center for just a second, maybe a different conversation, but very much, I think, reflects what we're talking about here. What about outside? What about, as you see the United States right now, compared, you know, you obviously have an ability to reflect attitudes any different than, let's say, 30 years ago? I mean, I'm just curious where you see that. I see you smiling as you're reflecting on it.
Yeah, I think about that all of the time. All of the time. And one of the reasons, so my background as an educator is early childhood development. So working with younger children and being around younger people, you have an opportunity to see hope and possibility. And I think a lot of times, many of us have a disconnect generationally from our younger people where we fail to see that hope and possibility, right? And because I have the opportunity to see that, I have a very optimistic view of the future. And it doesn't negate a lot of the challenges that I see that's going on right now. But my motto in life is, if you see something that's not present, like a lot of times people may complain about, okay, there's no businesses here. Oh, that's a vacant lot right here. Oh, this is not happening over there. To me, that is always evidence of your opportunity. It's evidence of your opportunity. And that is the way that I look at it. And I strive to inspire and encourage that in the next generation, because in a lot of ways, I don't have a lot of confidence and hope in some of the elder generation who are in a position to make certain decisions right now. But my way of bringing about a solution is to empower the younger generation so that they don't become those type of adults.
What challenges do you see the younger generation having as they move forward in life?
Part of it is that sometimes people think that they're not qualified to have a voice. You know, I've been to many conferences and retreats where you have adults talking about what we need to do for youth, and there's not one youth that's been invited to the conference or the retreat. Like, how do you expect to solve a problem and you're not including people? I've been to poverty conferences where there's not one poor person there or one unhoused person. Everybody has suits on. And they're driving away from this in a luxury vehicle. So the sense of voice and place and representation is something that the younger generation is. And you've seen this generationally, not just today. You go back to the 50s or the 60s, you see the exact same type of disconnect. And that is one of the reasons why when we see movements of change, it is always younger people who are at the forefront of bringing those changes. And usually they're the loudest, they're the ones who are protesting the most because they're not being heard. And I think they have a lot of answers and solutions, and it really requires us who are a little bit older to be willing to actually listen to them, because they're literally gonna be our leaders in the future, and just equip them with the proper tools so they can make better decisions than we did, which also requires some sense of vulnerability, because we have to acknowledge, like, we may have not made the best decisions. And some people, they are always right, you know? So.
What about Niagara Falls? So I'm just kind of, as we're kind of talking about your family a little bit, it sounds like are you originally from Niagara Falls?
Yes, I was born and raised here in Niagara Falls. Yes.
What's Niagara Falls for people of, what's it like for people of African descent?
It varies. Yeah. So we're not a monolith. You know, some people have different experiences than others, you know, but I think that one thing that we could all agree on in terms of something that we share in common is the socioeconomic landscape. And I think that's also something that's important when it comes to looking at history through that lens of socioeconomics, because sometimes people get divided on various different things instead of realizing that, yo, we are, in terms of class, we have much more in common and similar to each other than what we see that's actually different.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we've moved around through the cultural center here a little bit so far. Talked about just how it all kind of came to, you know, you were talking about it before, like, you know, it was an organic development here, but now you have to put it into action, and here we are, we're kind of like moving through this space. Talk a little bit about what went, you know, some of the thought process, and, you know, what you really wanted people to experience as they came through.
So part of that is when we first opened our doors in May of 2018, our plan was to prepare ourselves for guided tours and to maybe give it a month or two before we're able to start bringing people into the space for tours. That did not happen. We had people signing up for group tours. We had organizations signing up. We had people who wanted to book their family reunion and bring them into the space. So we had to give our community members and people who wanted to come into the space what they actually wanted. So that became a process of being able to put our Freedom Conversation Tour together. And when I say Freedom Conversation Tour, that's a little bit more unique than if you go to a museum or an art space where you have a docent that kind of gives you a tour. Our tours revolve around conversations. So we facilitate dialogue with guests that come into the space, so that not only are they learning about some of this content, but they have an opportunity to share. Because a lot of times people come into the space and they just think they're just coming here to learn about the Underground Railroad.
Right.
But people have an opportunity to make their own connections with some of the conversations that we're having.
Right. So they're not being dictated to them.
Exactly. Because
when a pushback.
Exactly. And then when a person shares because they made their own connection, you have evidence and you know for a fact that what you shared has value. They're showing you the value in what it is that they're sharing back to you. I've met people who talked to me about, we were having conversations about genealogy and doing research about your family background. I had a family that came in here and was talking to me about how they were in their 50s. They had just learned recently that their last name was not their ancestors' last name when they first came to America, because they were doing research and they realized that their family came from Ireland and they literally changed their last name because they were business owners and they knew that if they were rooted in a community and they had that Irish last name, that people would discriminate against them. So they changed it to assimilate into the society. But when they had children, they never told their children this story. When they got older and had children, they never told their children this story. So here you have three generations later of people just finding out in their 50s that the last name that they've always had and had pride in is not even what their ancestors had when they came to this country. And that is an epiphany that they had just coming into this space. They probably didn't come here thinking about we were going to be having this conversation. They probably just came here thinking they were going to learn about Harriet Tubman or something. But it's the way that we craft these conversations where people have an opportunity to share and to make the connections themselves in terms of this universal story of freedom seekers. We use the Underground Railroad as a backdrop to talk about freedom seekers, but this is a universal story. And like I mentioned originally, everybody has a story of freedom in their family. And it's on a person to discover those stories, because it's also a sense of knowing their own potential to be able to meet challenges, obstacles, and to overcome. And that is a fact because they are here right now. You would not be here if your family did not overcome those obstacles or challenges. So it's important to learn those stories and those decisions that people made in order for you to be here. And it gives you a deeper appreciation for those who you come from.
You know, it's one thing to say we're going to have conversations. Mm-hmm. And have to, Thomas and I can look at straight how it is to get conversations started sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's not simple. And the type of conversations you're talking about most certainly aren't easy. So there must be a lot of thought that goes into how you're going to get these conversations started with groups you may know nothing about. So what are some of the thoughts that go into that?
So it's kind of like a traffic light. You got green, you got yellow, and you got red. You don't start off with no red questions.
No, right? You don't start off with red questions.
You know what I'm saying? You start off with green questions. You know, where are you visiting from? How did you learn about our Heritage Center? Oh, okay. And usually you find out, like, they may have a history of the Underground Railroad or something in their home. They might just share right then and there. They may have that in their background, but they never heard about it before. So it creates an opportunity to find out where you can meet a person where they're at. Okay. As opposed to thinking that you're the expert and I'm going to tell you what this is. You got to meet people where they are so that you know for a fact that what you are sharing is going to have value, because you're meeting them where they are,
right?
Not expecting them to come to where you think and believe that you're at. Right. So that's one thing that's beautiful about our space, because every single tour is unique. It's based upon what people bring into the space. I was doing a tour a few months ago. It was a family from South Carolina, 11-year-old boy on that tour. And he knew so much about the Underground Railroad, he could give like a decent tour of the history. Not necessarily the stories of Niagara Falls and how that network operated here, but in general, this boy was sharp. Right. And he got that from his family and the school that he was going to. But then I've met people in their 60s who never heard of the phrase Underground Railroad before in their life. And they were not from another country. They were right from America. So engaging people and finding out where they are, you meet them where they're at.
So those are green light questions.
Mm-hmm.
What about the red light questions?
The light always turns red eventually.
The red ones we're about to get is, what do you think about those 34 felonies that that the former president just got, you know?
Uh-huh.
That's going to be a red one for okay. some people. Right?
Yeah.
And you have to figure out a way. Oh, definitely. Oh, without question. Somebody's going to have that conversation and want to discuss that from various different perspectives. Some people may want to discuss that from the perspective of, that's good. Some people may want to discuss it from the perspective of, he's unfairly being treated. Right? The goal is to facilitate a conversation around both perspectives so that this person that's over on the right will have the ability to think about the possibilities of looking at it from a different lens from the person on the left, and then vice versa. The person on the left can have an opportunity to listen to the perspective of the person that's on the right. The goal is, if we're going to have this conversation, what are you going to do about it as an everyday person living in a local environment that is connected to a local government, that's connected to a regional government? What power do you have, regardless of how that situation actually ends out? Right? Mm-hmm. So we don't run away from none of those type of conversations. We create this space where people can feel comfortable enough to say, this is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm thinking. Do you have any answers? Sometimes we may not have no answers, and that's the importance of facilitated dialogue, because somebody in the group may have an answer. So in facilitating those type of conversations, somebody may say, well, I think the former president was unfairly treated. I may pass it off or give an alley-oop to somebody else and say, well, what do you think about that? Do you think that's possible? I don't think that it's possible. Okay, well, do you think that it's possible? Yeah, I think it's possible. Okay, have you ever seen any other instances in history where something like this took place? And you can have conversations now where people have an opportunity to actually think outside of the box instead of just sharing something based upon their feelings. So we're like traffic, you know, guards, crossing guards. We facilitate conversations and sometimes it's uncomfortable. But the goal is to strive to get people to a place where they can think about the possibilities and then also their own sense of agency to be able to do something about it.
I'll ask a red question here, mm-hmm. because it's probably a question that came up now that you've mentioned the former president.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious, have there been discussions about former President Trump and... You know, I've had these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Is he a racist? He's not a racist. I've heard these types of things. I don't necessarily want to ask you yes or no about that question, but the type of conversations mm-hmm. I'm assuming mm-hmm. have occurred right in these spaces.
Oh, yeah.
What do we hear from people?
Man, I've had teachers come in here from Florida, and they were teaching in a school district in Florida, and they were telling me about the challenges with being able to teach certain subject matters because of the way that the governor has come down on some of the school districts in terms of content and the usage of certain type of phrases or words. And she was personally telling me how she's been struggling with being able to navigate and to do her job as an educator to make sure that her students are critical thinkers, but yet not being punished at the same time based upon the political landscape right in Florida. We've had people come through the space that are proudly wearing Confederate flags, right? And we have conversations about that. You know, some people will say, well, it's just a sense of pride. So then now you can get into another conversation. What kind of pride? What are you proud of, right? So, you know, depending upon whatever is happening in the current political landscape or even in the entertainment space, people will bring that into the space to try to get some sense of clarity. So as an institution, many organizations and agencies within our own community kind of come to us and look towards us for that leadership or guidance around these type of subject matters. So we partnership with our local school district, and there was an incident that happened at an Erie County school and a local school district where there was a soccer game going on, and some of the students here in the school district were playing at a soccer game, and the students at the other school district were making monkey noises and calling them out of their name. It took parents and advocates to come together to show up at the school board meeting at the other school district, and our superintendent at our school district also engaged the superintendent of that school district. And out of that came a project and an initiative where students from that school district now come together as leaders with students from this school district, and they do cultural enrichment activities so that they are in a position of agency to be able to teach their peers of what's appropriate, what's inappropriate, and so that they have that knowledge and wisdom. So that was an unfortunate incident to happen, but out of that came something productive. So we strive to take the same approach with people that may come into this space that may have certain type of ideas that some of us may or may not agree with.
As an educator yourself, mm-hmm. does it worry you to see across the country these school districts basically censor books, censor education?
What worries me the most, I think, is parents, guardians, caretakers not realizing their own sense of agency to direct our children's education. That even if somebody bans a book or does something like that, you have to figure out another way in order to help make sure that our children have these resources. And what worries me is sometimes parents, guardians, and caretakers may not be proactive or know their sense of agency to do it for themselves. And that's the kind of household that I came from. You know, my parents were all about self-determination and about being critical thinkers. And if there's a roadblock in front of you, figure out a way to navigate around it, through it, believe it, above it, push it out the way, do something in order to make sure that you're able to successfully, you know, go on the other side. So that's what worries me the most. I think just the masses of parents, guardians, and caretakers relying solely on institutions to control the education of our youth instead of realizing their own power to primarily do that.
As you said earlier, it takes a village.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're actually winding down on our time here. So before we go, we can't not, you know, give the ins and outs of exactly how people can come here, when they can come, what they can expect, what the best time is. What are, give us the elevator speech for the center.
Yeah, so our Heritage Center, our summer hours right now are Tuesday through Sunday. We're open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and we have tours every day at 11:30 and at 2 p.m. that comes along with your admission, so you don't pay anything extra for any of those tours. We're also, during the summer months, going to be doing Suspension Bridge Village tours, so I also do tours outside of the Heritage Center within the community to show people some of the landmarks that are still standing here so they can get a sense of the type of community that was around this area during that time period of the Underground Railroad. Also, if people are interested in learning more about the events that we have coming up, we're going to have a community day for Juneteenth, June 22nd. And I tell people to join our Facebook page because we constantly put out our events as well as other information that people can learn about the things and the activities that we're doing here at our Heritage Center.
And you see, I don't want to steal your tour outside this facility, but you're talking about some of the, what are some of those spots that you take people on for these tours? Again, I don't want to steal away from your stuff.
Yeah. Well, right outside of our Heritage Center is the Nexus or the Whirlpool Bridge, and that bridge was built on top of an older bridge known as Suspension Bridge. Suspension Bridge was the first international bridge that crossed into Canada, and this is the actual location that Harriet Tubman crossed in November of 1856. So I show people some of the remnants of the Suspension Bridge, which is literally right outside of our doors, and talk to them a little bit more about how this was an actual rendezvous point for freedom seekers. And I say rendezvous point because the station master, William Still, who lived in Philadelphia, in his notes often wrote about Suspension Bridge Village being a rendezvous point for freedom seekers. So he would direct people here to Niagara Falls, and Harriet Tubman was one of those people. So that's just one location that I show people, but I also show people the First Congregational Church, which is right around the corner from where the Suspension Bridge was. And then also, there was a school for colored, blind, deaf, and dumb children that was started by a man named P.H. Skinner, who was a man who would be classified as white, who started his journey in education in the Washington, D.C. area. And his school was built down, burnt down to the ground because he was teaching enslaved children that had disabilities. So whenever you look at the disability movement in this country, it goes back to a man named P.H. Skinner. And he actually had a school right here in Niagara Falls that he operated, which was also right around the corner from the Suspension Bridge. So I show people a lot of those various different locations.
You know, and I just thought... Yep, I'll probably step over here and or wherever I'll follow along. I'll follow you. You know, and to hear you talk about Suspension Village.
Uh-huh.
And Harriet Tubman crossing at that spot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing, you know, history is a lot of things, right? It's facts, it's figures, it's dates. But there's a sense, when you were just talking about it, mm-hmm. that there's almost a very spiritual kind mm-hmm. of sense to all of this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, facts and figures don't move people. Stories do, because that is the connection of humanity that we all share. And just being a person of African descent, and people from other different cultures as well, have always had a tradition of griots or story keepers or historians in their history and in their ancestry. And that's something that we've always valued. We've always been able to teach proverbs or Aesop fables, stories of wisdom or guidance through storytelling. And unless you're able to take those facts and figures and to show the humanity in that or in the actual human connection, then it's not going to mean anything.
Well, I really appreciate answering all my questions. I know they can be a little, they come from different parts of the field sometimes, but I most certainly appreciate it. Thank you.
I appreciate that as well. Appreciate that as well.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been a special What's Next from the Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center. We want to thank our guide, Heritage Center Director of Community Engagement, Saladin Allah. This is WBFO News and Buffalo, Toronto Public Media. This is WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.